Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, supported by Precision Hydration. If you're looking for an in-depth insight into the world of downhill and enduro mountain biking, then this is the place to be. Hydration is one of the essential pillars of performance and has a huge impact on how you feel in life in general. Staying hydrated isn't as easy as everyone sweats at a different rate and loses different amounts of electrolytes in that sweat. Precision Hydration are here to help by providing a range of variable strength electrolytes and either an in-person sweat test or a free online questionnaire to help you optimize your hydration. I've put a link to the free online questionnaire in the show notes for this episode, so head there to answer a few simple questions and get your free plan. I've been following my Precision Hydration plan and using their electrolytes for a while now, and I'm really happy with the results. I'm feeling less fatigued in general, and that's especially noticeable when I'm training or riding on back-to-back days. And I also feel way less fuzzy and wiped out after long rides, so I've definitely felt the benefits. To get your free hydration plan, visit precisionhydration.com, fill out their online questionnaire, or book yourself in for an in-person sweat test. If you want to use their range of top quality electrolytes, then as a Downtime listener, you get 20% off using the code DOWNTIME, all in capitals at the checkout. This podcast still relies on your support, so please let your friends know about the podcast. You could recommend an episode that you've really enjoyed and tell them why they should give it a try. You can also help out by following us on social media, where we're at Downtime Podcast, leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen, and making sure that you subscribe to the podcast and to our weekly newsletter. And you can do that over at downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. If you want to help support financially, then you can do that by getting yourself something from our web store at downtimepodcast.com/shop. It's all organic, ethically sourced, shipped without using any single-use plastics, and there's free worldwide shipping on orders over £30. All the proceeds go to helping improve the podcast. All right, this week on the podcast, I'm sitting down with Rick McLaughlin. If you've watched the coverage of the Downhill World Cup or the EWS, then you'll have seen Rick at work, bringing us trackside insight from the world's top riders. We sat down to find out more about his career, how he ended up in his current role, and what it takes to bring us the awesome coverage that we get from World Cups and EWS rounds. So, without further ado, here's Rick McLaughlin. Rick McLaughlin, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going good, actually. Nearly end of the season, nearly time to stop moving, so I'm pretty good.
Yeah, a lot of movement for you. Big season. Let's rewind the clock then and find out kind of how it all started for you. Okay. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and how bikes came into it.
My childhood and how bikes came into it, basically. I think it started, I went to the doctors when I was a kid, and in the doctors they had that generic pile of magazines that every doctor surgery has. And there was a copy of MBUK on the top of it, and I looked back through the archives and tried to find the issue, but I couldn't find it. But there was a front cover that just sort of like pulled me into it, and I was quite a tubby kid, and I hadn't really found a sport that I really enjoyed. Like, I was a kid who was a goalkeeper and stuff, just because okay. I wasn't very good at running about, and yeah, it sort of it tripped something in me, and then I got a mountain bike, just like a giant boulder, I think it was, and just got really into it. And I got into BMX for a bit after that, and then came back to mountain biking again around the middle of the 90s at some stage.
Yeah. So how old would you have been when you were in this doctor surgery then? Was it?
I don't know, maybe 6 or 7. So I've okay. always been pretty into it, and I've always loved magazines, and aside from hair growth, probably my only other talent is retaining information from magazines. So like, I just always had this anoraki sort of, and whenever I was younger, it was like when we were in high school, you had a homework diary, this little book that you schedule your homework in. And me and my mates always had like the MBUK release date for next month in the homework diary. And then it was like a physical, like a foot race to get from school to Easons, the news agents, to get the next MBUK as quickly as you could, and that was it.
Yeah, devoured cover to cover, and yeah, multiple times.
Yeah, yeah, and pass around, and like new bikes, and it was the days never chain reaction. You used to have the big like double page, yeah. Actually sometimes 4-page ads with all the prices for stuff that you could like, and you'd sort of yeah. So just always been into it, really.
Yeah. And with the riding side of things, was it always like a gravity fed enjoyment, or did you just enjoy being out on bikes?
I listened to one of your last ones you did with Rob Weaver, and he came up with a really structured way of how he went through racing and sort of, not, I didn't do that. My parents owned a pub, so I rode a mountain bike around in circles in a pub car park for a lot of years. And then I got a plank of wood and made a jump out of a plank of wood, and I still can't jump. But a lot of it was just riding around where I was from, and it was a way of getting around, and it was really, really good. And then my friend down the road, Stu, he got into bikes as well, and we'd sort of race each other everywhere, and it was always that kind of like involvement. But I think gravity, the interest in gravity stuff really came from those MBUK days of like Petey and Warner. Actually, Warner might listen, might take that as a compliment, so just Petey. Petey was a big influence on me for a long, but that's whenever Britain was massive. I think that was really that era of the Grundigs and stuff like huge for me.
Yeah, well, we were doing a pretty good job of bringing home the results.
Yeah, back then. And I think as well, what's really changed is that in terms of what I do in World Cup reporting, there's a large chunk of my life where I read about World Cups every month. It was like you would read about Nevagal or Snoqualmie. Like, you had to wait for a magazine to come out. There was nowhere else you could get the information. So it was like you got it and like you kept it in the bag to keep it good in your school bag. Then you got home, opened it up, and you like straight to the racing pages, and you read all the stuff about racing, and so that you could then talk the next day with some kind of authority about racing. And I've sort of been doing it ever since.
Yeah, it's interesting. So from an early age, that was your thing, like consuming the data to give yourself an educated position on what was going on in racing.
I've always had a thing, and I still have it. I think it's fascinating. The idea of who can ride a bicycle down a mountain the quickest, I think it's just fascinating. And it's really stuck with me.
Yeah, interesting. So magazines were obviously a thing from a young age, mm-hmm. and bikes were a thing. Mm-hmm. At what point did the two collide? Was there as a young kid, did you think, oh, I can make these two things, I can bring them together and make a career out of this? Or where did you kind of head at the end of school?
Weirdly, I wasn't very good at school. I didn't understand a lot of it. And if I didn't, I had quite a clear idea from an early age that, like, physics, and I was like, I will never need to know this. I knew that, like, and I was quite bad, that what I was into, the subjects that I was into, which were English and art, I really liked, and I really, like, could get quite good grades in that, but everything else really just fell by the wayside. And I was sort of heading more towards art at one stage, and I decided I was going to be a transport designer because I heard that there wasn't very many of them and they got paid quite well. So that, you know, and it would be an excuse to draw cars for the rest of my life. So I was doing this A-level project about transport design, and part of that was writing a dissertation, which was, I think it was like 1500 words or something, like, uh-huh. by now, like, it wasn't a lot, but then it was huge. And I started talking to this transport designer via email, who answered very kindly, answered my questions, and I sort of realized that I was enjoying that more than the actual physical art side of it, the actual drawing the cars, and that sort of led me to go down the road of journalism. So uh-huh. then I applied for a journalism degree at Napier University in Edinburgh, and went for the interview, and they said you need two B's and a C, which is art, English, and business studies. And I got two B's and squeaked a C in business studies, went there, did a 4-year honours degree in journalism, which I loved, which was really, really good. And I finished that, came out of that, and like, I went home for 3 or 4 months, which was a bit of a sort of a culture shock after you've been away
yeah.
at uni for a long time. And I worked as a runner on a documentary for the BBC about Northern Ireland and the World War II conflict, about flying boats, because the Catalinas went out in Northern Ireland and they found submarines and stuff. And loved that, but was doing it for free. And a guy I went to uni with then sent me an email. He'd found this job as an editorial assistant at Mountain Bike in UK magazine. And he said, oh, you like bikes, don't you? You should apply for this. And I was like, actually, yeah. Applied for it, went to Bath, flew to Bristol, got a taxi to Bath, did the job interview, put a deposit on a rental flat in Inverness with my girlfriend, then got the job in Bath and lost the deposit. So,
well, worst things could have happened, I
guess.
Yeah,
it turned out all right in the end.
Yeah, so you're on a plane off to Bath at this point then. So you lived locally?
I lived in County Down, which is a little village called Spain, which is near Cumber.
Yeah.
For those of you who know the County Down area well. And yeah, that was a big step. I'd never been to southwest of England before that, so that was huge.
Yeah, that is a big change, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that job involve? Because I don't really understand what that means you're doing for MBUK.
An editorial assistant is basically your first rung in the ladder. And that when I first started there, I think I was getting over. I'm sure their pay structures changed completely, but I was getting just over £1,000 a month. And I remember thinking, I could live like a king on this. That's £1,000 a month. And then you realise like the average Bath rent's like £1,500 a month.
Yeah.
And you get in trouble quite quickly. Basically, an editorial assistant is the tea boy. Like you do as much as you can. The first 2 or 3 months there, I was packing test bikes in the boxes and sending bikes back. And then slowly but surely, they were very good to me and they gave me more and more pieces to write. And they saw that I could write a bit and then they gave me more and more. And that sort of then, I worked there for just over 4 years and I left as the senior staff writer.
Okay.
So I worked my way up to there.
Yeah. And was that kind of, I love at first sight, sounds kind of odd in this context, but did you know straight away, I'm in the right sort of place here, this is the kind of thing I want to be doing?
I didn't actually. I got a bit of a complex that like I wanted to be quite a serious journalist, and I sort of wanted to go to papers and I wanted to go to other things, and that this was, and I always knew it was a brilliant job, but I sort of worried that it was all I'd ever do,
uh-huh.
like, because it was my hobby and I'd sort of get stuck there. And I love my time there, but I didn't see myself living in Bath for the rest of my life either. It wasn't really for me. My girlfriend, who's now my wife, lived in Inverness and Scotland. I'd been to uni in Scotland. A lot of my friends were still in Scotland. A lot of my friends were back home. And I was sort of, it wasn't somewhere that I sort of thought that would work for me, but then it ended up working.
So yeah.
That was quite good.
Yeah, yeah. So 4 years at MBUK, worked your way up.
Yeah.
Where did you go after that?
I randomly talked to a man called James Rennick in a bar at Eurobike. He was working for Factory at the time. And I was sort of thinking about going freelance because I sort of thought that I was conscious of the fact that, well, it was partly my own making. I was volunteering more and more features in Scotland so I could go to Scotland on the lash for the weekend and ride bikes. And I sort of thought, If I went freelance, could I pick up enough work, a couple of features a month, would that be enough to live up there and stuff? And I sort of chatted to him, and then he sent me an email one day saying, can you email me back on your personal email? And at this stage, he'd moved to Red Bull. And I said, yeah. And he said, I'm looking for someone who can help run our website 2 to 3 days a week. And I was like, oh, 2 to 3 days a week, it's not a lot to quit your job over. And then I realized that I could get the same sort of money for those 2 or 3 days a week, plus have 2 days a week to do other work as I was currently being paid. And the company at the time was in, there was 2 or 3 rounds of redundancies and we were getting more and more work. there was a website launched that ultimately didn't last, and we were just getting more and more sort of work piled on. It was the time, it was around the time that Apple Newsstand was happening and magazines didn't know what was going on. And,
right.
And I just took a plunge and went, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll go, and did it. And yeah, I've not looked back since. It was one of the biggest decisions I made, but I think it's one of the best I've made as well.
Yeah. And so was that that was your aim with Red Bull at that point?
Yeah. So basically then I went to, was it 3 or 4 World Cups at the end of, what year would that have been? That would have been 2013. I would have gone 2 or 3 at the end of 2013. At the second one I went to, I turned an entire edit suite off and got a massive bollocking in German and thought that this is it. You've left your job for no, you'll never be back at another World Cup. But somehow I got back in because originally I was just writing about them for online.
Okay.
Which was, it was my dream. It was like going to a World Cup to write about it. Like the two things that I loved the most. It was fantastic. And then we went to Cairns. I forget, was it 14? And it was my first real long-haul flyaway one. And I went, and XCE was still a thing then, and they needed somebody to do field reporting, to ask questions at the bottom of the winners of the XCE. And I was volunteered for this and sort of went, oh, and ugh. And I did it, and then, because I have no confidence, like, completely, like, I was apologising before that they even got to me, and they're like, no, you did okay, you can do downhill tomorrow. And I was like, pfft. And then, in that race, I don't know if you remember, Adam Brayton crashed, broke his leg.
Yeah.
And because of the way they built the track in the rainforest, spectator access was up through the track. And a guy got on his bike to bring the bike down, had a huge crash, really hurt himself. But that left us with, like, I think it was like 35 or 40 minutes of a track hold. So between Rob and Claudio in the booth and me, we had to fill and cover all this. So I had to keep grabbing people for interviews. Team managing, I got Dan Brown, Kathy Sessler, I got David Vasquez, I got any rider that was anywhere near me. And the race finished. G won it, actually. G won it on borrowed shoes.
I remember that, yeah.
And I stood in the finish area and Lawrence Crossman Ames was walking down towards me and there was no one else about. And he was like, well, did you enjoy that? And I was just ashing and I was just like, no, I'm never doing that again. And I was like, that was the most stressful hour and a half of my life I'd ever experienced. And then, yeah, did the next one, still doing it.
So in at the deep end, did you have any chance to prepare? Like, did you have notes? Were you literally just thrown in, right, you're going to be on the live feed, crack on?
Yeah, that was it, basically. And my boss, Alex Althoff, who's actually just done his last World Cup in snowshoe, and Christoph Trichner, from the start, they were very, very good to me in that they basically know that I'm a geek and they know that I maybe know enough to get 2 or 3 cohesive questions out in a row, and just, they've always had faith in me doing it. And that's the sort of thing you come back to when you're most nervous. You're just like, these people think that you can do it.
Yeah.
Just do it. Awesome. I still find it really stressful. It's not.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, anything where you're stood in front of a live audience, or not. Yeah, you know it's getting broadcast around the world to tens
and
of thousands.
My big fear as well is, like, because I've got, obviously I'm Northern Irish, but I live in Scotland, so I've got a weird sort of hybrid across the Irish Sea sort of accent. But when you get stressed, your accent gets thicker and you speak quicker, and you're talking to people who English is maybe their third language. Yeah. For some of the cross-country athletes. And my big fear to begin was with, they'll not understand me. And then I can't remember who it was didn't and asked me to repeat the question, and I did, and I thought, that's it, you've cocked up, you're gone. And it's fine. it's like they just asked you to ask the question again, and you did. They understood it, and it's actually no children get hurt or like nothing blows up. There's no one dead. No car explodes. It's just like live's live, and whatever happens once the camera goes live, it happens. And the best that you can do is just try and keep calm and shovel on.
And what do you think it is about you that makes you good at that? Because to be able to go in at the deep end and do a decent job straight off, there must be some.
See, I don't think I'm that good at it. I'm terrified by it. I don't know. I think having a background that has trained me professionally in some part of my head to think like a journalist, and like you always know what's you sort of have a good beat on what questions you should be asking, what the most immediate thing, because they've just finished a downhill run at insane speed down the side of a mountain, what's the most immediate thing that they want to talk about? And then once they get that out, they're probably going to want to talk about the bigger picture and sort of having an understanding of that a bit. But also, in my ears, I've got Rob and Claudio's commentary. So I sort of have an idea of the storyline of the race and what's happened and what's gone on. And you write loads of notes. You buff, like you're like a sponge for details before a race. So you sort of have an idea of what's happened before that point.
So what does a World Cup race week look like from your perspective then? When do you turn up and what things do you go through to get prepared for race day?
I turn up on usually a Tuesday. Depends what day I get in, but initially it's about a day and a half of planning, note taking, reminding myself of what happened at the last race. So that's often for me flicking through the previous live feed as well as reading my notes from that race and updating. Social media now is a big thing as well in terms of racing. You get a lot of information on there that you don't get other places. People volunteer a lot of stuff on there that might get missed, so sort of have a troll through that. It gets busy for me really on Friday morning, because Friday morning usually I'll do the XCO course preview, which is even more nerve-wracking. Then I'll try and ride that track before it, but Friday morning sometimes is the first time I get a chance to ride it. And then I do that, I'll do a pit tech walk video, which we do as live but isn't live. Then I do downhill quali, which again we do as live but isn't live. So there's a bit of, it's more enjoyable because you know that the camera's not live, but you can have a bit of fun. And I sort of really trust the guys that Dan and Liv will film it, that they're not going to hang you out to dry and stuff and looking like a muppet. And then Friday night, XCC. So that's short track. That's two live broadcasts very close together. Mm-hmm. They're the most stressful for me because there's lots of call-up box interviews and you don't really get a chance to prepare your questions for whoever wins it, because you don't know who wins it until often the last 20 feet of it.
Yeah.
So that's really stressful whenever you're sort of flying on a wing and a prayer a wee bit. Then Saturday is downhill, so you might have a bit of a technical rehearsal at some stage on Saturday morning or maybe on the Friday just to get something else in the Friday. Then you do downhill. I'll be there. I like to be there for juniors because I like to, it's a race that I can watch that I don't have anything to do with, but then it's handy to sort of know who's going to be up next year and what their performances are like. Make notes on that. Then women's race, men's race. Then there's usually a meeting to prepare for cross country the next day. Then cross country, two live broadcasts on Sunday.
Wow, it's a busy week then.
It's busy and it builds is the thing, the workload builds. The start of the year, like when you go to Fort William and you tell yourself you're really busy, you're not. Like you've got two races to cover. It's whenever it gets to the end of the year and the triples arrive in the form of XCE and XCC, I should say, downhill and cross country, then it gets real busy.
And the story develops over the year, I guess. At the start of the year, there's less story, right? There's last year,
yeah.
But then you haven't got the drama building throughout the season. And
And it's really key to identify, and we just had it this year in EWS, in that Sam Hill has been third or fourth in the championship all year. But you've got to keep an eye on that, because you know that if something happens to one of those riders ahead of him, like it has happened to Eddie, then he's in with a shot to win the championship. So you can't get to a point at the end of the year where you're talking about him for the first time.
Yeah.
So you've got to sort of always be mindful of the bigger picture of it.
Yeah. And has anything ever gone wrong at a World Cup? Like what makes your life harder? Because there's always tech glitches and...
The hardest thing for me personally, for what I do, is if I have technical problems with sound, because I've had it before where I've got two earpieces in and I've got Rob and Claudio in one ear and I've got the director and the truck in the other ear. Uh-huh. And then you add on to that, you've got a PA system, you've got crowd noise, and you've got a person in front of you that's potentially telling you something that they're going to retire because they've just found out their wife's pregnant with triplets or something. And if you don't hear that, but you can get technical problems, like if you go somewhere where there's lots of antennas. The worst is if you get a delay.
Right.
So your mic's live and you're talking into your mic and then your voice is coming back to you at half the speed it's going into the mic. So then you speed up to speak quickly and then that's horrible. Yeah. I've had that. I've had feedback, really. Mont Saint-Anne's usually really good for feedback just because of the way the antennas are and where the lifts are and stuff. You get, 3 years ago, cross country, I made the mistake of going to the downhill party and bumping into Mark Beaumont. That was my mistake. And I had a bit of a hangover on the Sunday and I was stood in a roasting hot technical area, sun beating down, no shade. I'm not good in the sun. And basically, I had static, like really, but just white noise, just. But the truck was really, really faint. My director was really, really, and the commentary was really, really faint.
Yeah.
And the sound man was like, it's the best we can do. So I had to have it up, like as loud as it would go. And I was just stood just in agony going, oh. So that's about. And then, but you still, with live TV, it's like, you've still got to do a cohesive job. You've still got to go and ask accurate questions and be mindful of what's happening around you. So whenever one of your senses is taken away from you, that's difficult.
For sure. How was the snowshoe? Because the atmosphere seemed insane. Like it was noisy, right?
Yeah, it was real noisy. And what they'd done as well is like basically because of the sponsorship agreements and stuff, I always have to interview people in front of that board that's in the background. And they'd helpfully put that board up against a grandstand. So there was like fans hanging down and fans hanging in from the side. And it was such a race. The atmosphere at it was unbelievable. And I didn't hear any of Danny's answers.
Wow.
And I was stood closer to him than I'm stood to you now. And you just have to go with like, cool. and yeah, now and again, you have to pull your ears out just because you can't hear them because you've got earbuds in. And then whenever you pull your ears out, then you're outside the safety bubble of someone telling you, ask them about this, ask them about that. And then you have to rely on. So I've got a little notebook that I keep 4 or 5 questions for each of who I think the top 5 are going to be.
Right.
If they win it. And then as they come down, they get crossed off. So I don't accidentally look down and ask them someone else's question.
Okay.
So you've just got to be confident that your timings in your head are roughly about right and that the questions you're asking are right. So, but if I've had commentary, if I've had Rob and Claudio in my ear, it should be all right because I'm aware of the story that sort of happened.
Yeah, you know what's happened.
But if I lose them, yeah, it's issues.
Yeah, cool. And then what about the EWS side of things? How did that come about? Because you've been doing that for a while now as well.
Yeah. I think Chris Ball, Baller, rang me. He emailed me first and he said, could he give me a ring? And then he rang me and said that they were looking for a presenter, producer, and would I like to do it? And I said, I'd love to do it, but I'm obviously still doing World Cups. And I could do both in theory. And he was prepared to work with that, which is very good of him. And yeah, I've been doing that. I think I went for a coffee before I went to his house for the interview. I went for a coffee with Rory Cunningham and asked him what he thought of me doing both, and was a good idea, a bad idea. He told me it was a good idea, then basically told Baller straight away he's not sure if it's a good idea or not. So then, yeah, always nice to have mates you can trust.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
Yeah, that was good.
Sweet. And that's a very different week, yeah?
That's a very different week, yeah. It's my week at the EWS is probably busier, just because we have a smaller team and we're involved in a lot more things, but it's often a more exciting week, I guess, because you're right, like there's no buffer. World Cups, I'm a cog of a big machine. There's like 70 people at a World Cup sometimes.
Wow.
Whereas at EWS, there's seven of us.
Okay.
Really, that are like full-time sort of putting all the content out. And I think what we produce is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, for the size of team. Yeah.
Everyone works so hard and it's absolutely incredible, yeah.
Yeah. And so you turn up and one of the first things, or certainly from my perspective, one of the first things it seems you do is get thrown down all the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was something I was really conscious of when I started doing. I said to Baller, like, I'm not a great bike rider by any means. Unless you put me in a pub car park, then I'm really, really quick around the outside of it. But and I was really conscious. And for me, it was a really difficult thing because I wasn't used to putting my riding out into a public domain is quite a personal thing. And it was quite and I think the way Chris has become more involved in the previews and stuff, I think is really beneficial because you get to see the ex-World Cup racer, which he is, and I'd like to point that out as often as I can. You get to see it at his like incredible speeds, and the information he can deliver whilst talking and riding at that speed is it's both incredible and sickening. And then you get to see it at my sort of wobbler speed, which is... Like somebody said to me the other day, they're like, "Oh yeah, really? I really like the fact that you do it, and you're like, you're an average fast rider." I was like, "I'm not even fast, man. I'm not even average." But yeah, it's those days are not stressful, but you're conscious of like, and if one of us has a crash, it happened in Snowshoe Chris, had quite a big crash, and it's happened before. I really hurt my shoulder in Madeira. Then but again, you've still got to produce something out of it. Something still has to come out of it, and it's it's hairy, but yeah, the EWS are brilliant at finding good venues, though. So it's always a good time.
Yeah, sweet. I'll let you have a drink of your beer.
Yes, I have got a pint on the go.
So, tell us a bit about the tracks. Then, what level is that series at now? From someone who, a normal rider having a go
average
at it.
Fast rider, it was called. Yeah,
average fast rider. There you go.
they are, I think, at their most extreme, difficult, but not, for my level of riding, not impassable. Like,
okay.
I think they do a really, really good, I mean, it's a really, really difficult job. They've got to provide race courses that the pros can race and enjoy. But at the same time, it's a massive participation thing, the EWS. You've got to, me and my mates have to be able conceivably to go there and to enjoy our race.
Yeah.
And I think it's a brilliant level. And I think it's a real world championship in terms of if you come out of that with a win, you are the best person at riding a mountain bike because the sheer variety of terrain is across a year staggering. Yeah. Especially when you go to places like Chile or Tasmania and then you go to like Olargue or La Tuile. It's a very, I think the whole point of it is you've got to be the complete rider to win there. And I think the tracks are really good at representing that.
Yeah, it certainly looks challenging, but looks to the point where you'd be like, well, we could probably ride most of it.
Yeah. I think it's still, I mean, it's not like if I go to Val Nord or Val de Sole and I look at stuff and go, I couldn't ride that.
Right.
I think there's only been one or two things that I've walked on an EWS course preview and I've been quite open about it and said, I can't ride down that. And I'm never going to, the whole point of doing those previews is not to, it's not a self-glorification thing. And I think people quite like the fact that, you know, it looks hard.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to be honest about that. I'm not a good enough writer not to be, so.
That's good. I think it's good that there's that honesty, and it shows, gives a feel for the actual level of some of this.
Yeah.
It's insane.
I think the XCO ones are all, they're almost more daunting because you're revving so high. You're only riding for 4 kilometers, but you just get taken apart on them. You get pulled apart like a cheese string. Like
it's, do the riders like to pull you apart? Is that part of it?
There's some of them, yeah. There's some of them have the odd nibble now and again, and you just go, like, okay. But again, like, I seem to be making an unfortunate sort of career path out of people enjoying seeing me being in discomfort, do you know what I mean? And being sort of like out of my comfort zone. But I go to like Nova Mesto because I've got a bike there because I do the previews now. I would go out in the evenings and do a couple of laps of that track because it's fun.
Right.
Whereas I'm so happy I didn't have to ride Mont Saint Dan this year because it was Worlds and I wasn't there, because that is just so savage. And I think mountain biking is in there with motorsport in that cameras don't really do a lot of it justice. I mean, you saw that camera shot from the top of that. Was it the unfair, the hell of Mont Saint Dan, that climb, that switchback climb? And it's, I don't think I could get a bike to the top of that. Do you know what I mean? I really don't think I might be able to. No, I've tried and I couldn't. Yeah, I think to do 7 laps of that at race speed whilst racing people and trying to think tactically and not getting punctures and then plummeting. Basically, it goes up like that. There's 2 or 3 bike lengths and then you go down this off camber rock chute on those little bikes with little tires, no brakes.
Yeah.
It's what they do is incredible.
Yeah, they're mad athletes, eh?
Hmm. I think it's really underestimated in mountain biking circles how good cross-country riders are, really.
Yeah. Yeah, having seen a couple of them ride in person fairly recently, it's a level I wasn't expecting.
No. And it's, for the majority of them, it's pre-drop or post.
Yeah.
Like they could ride it all with saddles up and stuff, which I just find boggling.
Yeah, that's mad, isn't it? So what, talk a bit about the EWS from a logistics perspective then, because it's very spread out.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to keep up with what's going on to enable you to ask good questions.
Yeah.
How do you manage that throughout a race week?
It's really, really difficult because we've basically 2 guys that are permanently on stages shooting, and we have Nico who will go out maybe at the start of the day. He's the main director and editor, so he's spending most of the race day editing what's coming back to him. But we have to move those 2 cameramen. I'm at the bottom of the stages doing the interviews, so we have to move the 3 of us from stage to stage to stage in a fashion that fits in with the start times. We had a bit of stress in snowshoe because basically I needed to be there for the elite men finishing at the bottom of, say, stage 4, whatever it was. As I was supposed to be there, timing-wise, you were well into the elite women's race on another stage. So there's a lot of logistics. Duncan Philpott is the mastermind of a lot of how we get our coverage because he's just brilliant with numbers and timings and logistical. My brain doesn't really work like that, so I tend to shut up a lot and just let Duncan talk. And we write it down and gets it all sorted out. But that could be anything from the guys taking their bikes and riding across another stage. It could be quad bikes. It could be pickup trucks. And all the time that you're doing that, you're trying to work out what's actually happening in the race because there's so many riders and obviously there's the overall, there's stage wins. So you spend a lot of time refreshing the live timing on the site, and we have a WhatsApp group that's usually open, and we have radios for backup. And all the time you're trying to make sure that you've got, because we've had recently like Rafaela Richter, riders like that, who don't have EWS points. So they start very, very early in the order.
Yeah.
And then they're setting times that are winning stages, and you're sort of like, oh, how are we going to get cameramen on them? And there's a lot of times then, thankfully, if it's a 2-day race, like in that instance, it was a 2-day race, so she got moved into an elite group to represent her, because it's difficult for them because they're obviously meeting people, they're passing people, and stuff, so it works better for them. And then on Monday, you sit down with a massive spreadsheet of all the results and you try and sort of pull stories out of it and work out. You start at the end, who won it, and then sort of work back and then work out a voiceover script. The voiceover script then gets read in front of what Nico and maybe Seeger have done with the stages. That tells the story properly. Then we make changes, then we record the voiceover, and then it gets watched. And
wow. How long does it take then from starting writing the script to getting the final product out the door?
Well, you see, I always say writing the script's actually like my favourite part of the weekend, because it's just me sat in front of a laptop typing where I'm really happy and I'm just like, yeah, I can do that, writing about bike racing, fine. I'll maybe start at 9 a.m. on the Monday, and then we'll try and get the film online for Monday night.
Okay, so it's a full day.
It's a full day, but we'll have already got maybe the first couple of stages edited by then. And it's always just, it's Mondays. I don't know how Nico does it. Yeah, a lot of respect for him to be able to sit and just commit to working on something for that period of time. Then you've got any number of curveballs. Like when we're in Chile, like there was a power cut in the media room and stuff like that goes down, and it gets later and later and later. And yeah, massive respect to the whole team. They're brilliant at what they do.
Fair play. So out of all of these amazing places that you've got to visit and to ride, are there any favourites, any standouts? Like if you're going to tell people you've got to go here.
There's a lot. Derby in Tasmania was absolutely magic. Canazei this year I really, really liked as well. And that was somewhere that when you're fortunate enough to work in a job where you get to see a lot of places, whenever you get that feeling of like, oh, I'll come back here with my family, or I'll come back here in my own time, I think that's a really good indicator. I really like that. North Star, I just had a great time in North Star. Truckee, hanging out there. That was my first time in California. That was really cool. It's rarer to go somewhere not so nice, do you know what I mean? I think that's maybe because I'm a big fan of bikes and bike racing, that I'm usually sort of in a happy place at a bike race.
Yeah, it's just a good place to be, full stop.
Yeah.
All your friends are there.
Yeah.
Away you go.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So obviously a lot of the journalism that you do now is kind of creating stories for camera.
Mm-hmm.
You're still doing some writing as well, yeah?
Yeah, it's mainly now in the off season because obviously I'm away so much, but I've done some writing for Seb at Cranked. I've done stuff recently. The last 2 or 3 years I've been doing stuff for James Misspent Summers for Hurley Burley and the EWS, the World Stage Book as well. I've been writing for them. And I've done stuff for Red Bullet in the past, and I've written stuff for Lonely Planet as well. And that's sort of still that's where I'd say I'm happiest and most comfortable is. That's what my actual skill set, I think, is, right? Right. I think the TV is just sort of like a happy charade that like someone will catch me out on eventually and say, wait a minute, you're not actually that good looking and you're not that good at it, so they'll just get rid of you.
Well, so where do you see yourself then? If the TV is maybe not your calling as such, is there still like an inner part of you that wants to do, you mentioned earlier, like serious journalism?
No, serious is maybe the wrong. I think at that time I thought serious was working at a paper or.
Okay.
I'd say now what I do is serious.
Yeah.
And I think that. I think the more journalists we have in mountain biking in particular, the better. I got told, I'm not going to mention the name who it was who told me, I got told by somebody at another magazine at one stage that I wasn't a proper bike journalist because I'd never worked in a bike shop.
Strange.
Yeah, and I sort of pointed out, well, you've like, there's a, I don't know, yeah, it's, that was a tricky sort of, I think there was a, whenever I first got into it, there was this feeling that you had to have worked in a bike shop, and that, you know, you weren't really into mountain biking or a serious mountain biker unless you worked in a bike shop. And I think at that time, bike shops, they'd become a bit like, I'm a big fan of music as well. They become a bit like music shops where there was a sort of almost a sneery sort of, oh, you're buying that, are you? Yeah. And I don't know what I'd do. I'm sort of making it up as I go along, and it's working out at the minute. So I'd love to do. There's so many things I keep on thinking I'd love to do, and it's sort of getting to the point where you've got to commit to doing them at some stage. But
watch this space.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. Keep an eye on it, but you know, don't commit too much time to watching it because there mightn't be anything on. But
fair enough. So, you see a lot of racing throughout the year, like you say, you're keen on kind of watching juniors and stuff as mm-hmm. well. Who are your picks for the top? Like, who have you spotted? Who do you think's on the way up?
Well, it's too easy to say Valley Hall, isn't it? She's just unbelievable. So I'm not delve into.
How do you think she'll get on next year? First year elite though.
I think she'll win one by the end of the year.
Really?
I think she'll take the first, because we're sort of in two blocks for World Cups next year. I think she'll have first half getting used to it, getting up to speed. Second half, I'd say she'll be winning them.
You think there's more speed in her than we've seen?
I think there's a good bit more speed in there, and I think she's confident, but not in a cocky way. I think she knows the big thing with juniors is always them adjusting to the speed of going into elites. Like riders, even riders like Briceland, he had a couple of years where he didn't really get a lot of good results. I remember I did an interview with Petey once, and he told me that people don't realise the difference in the physical training that you need to make from going from being a junior to an elite because of that speed differential.
Okay.
And it can take a couple of years physically for your body to get used to it. And then you can start challenging. And that happened, I think that happened with Josh. Sam Dale's another one. Like, he sort of was a slow burn initially and then got very, very good. I'd say, yeah, Valley, she's confident and she's so young. And I think one of the big things of young riders, if they're confident enough to know that they've got time, and she knows that, she's in no hurry.
Yeah, true.
I'd say that the other, I think there's two big talents at the minute are Thibaut Dupréla, obviously, as well, who even for a junior looks about 35. He looks like my age, so like, but he's just, I think you're starting to see the physical form of downhillers getting bigger and stronger, and he's already got a really big frame and obviously trains very well. Has ridden with Nico Vullio from an early age. Is with Max Commensal, like the godfather of bringing fast French riders on.
Yeah,
he's on a bike that is the bike of the moment, really, and I think he'll do really, really well. And I also think Antoine Vidal as well, another Frenchman, second at downhill worlds this year, and romping away a lot of the time with the under 23s at EWS.
Yeah,
and he's just like, he's one of those riders who seems to be going faster than everybody else, but really enjoying himself. And sort of, I think if you've got that pocket of performance, then you can only move up from it. Bruni was like that as well, actually.
Yeah. What is it about this French scene? It's gone crazy again, isn't it?
It has,
they seem to be really dominating.
When I started covering, when I first started traveling to bike races to cover them, the French were really nowhere. Damien Spagnolo was like the big sort of hope at that stage. I remember watching a World Cup at a press camp in a bar with Fabien Barrel, who was going through spasms of agony because he'd just recently retired, and Damien was his big hope. And they're just, yeah, they're on a different page at the minute. And especially in terms of, I always like, you look a bit further down the rankings at the riders who are 3 or 4 years younger than the guys who are at the top. And just so many strong French riders. I mean, we're at Red Bull Hardline at the minute, and Thibaut Lally's here.
Yeah.
He's like, he rode for an RS and did everything. You know, there's something clicking at the minute in that scene. But then there wasn't the British scene for years.
There was, but what do you think about upcoming British hopes?
I think it's leaner than it's been. I think I mean, Joe Breeden's a tremendous rider.
Yeah.
I think they're stopping that team next year, so that could be a where he ends up next could be a pivotal sort of moment for him in terms of his development. I also think Jacob Dixon could kick on as well. He's a very, very good Northern Irish rider from about 20 minutes down the road from me, so I sort of have to say him. But I think there is talent there. There's some even younger guys again. But yeah, it's difficult to say. It's difficult to say at the minute. It sort of feels like the National Series maybe isn't what it once was, which was in Britain, it was very much a case of, I think a lot of our strength came from the fact that you could comfortably travel in a van to every race, which sounds really simple. But if you think about America or Australia, that's flights with bikes, with teams, with, you don't have that cohesion. Whereas, like, you know, even if you live down south, 9 hours to Fort William, 10 hours to Fort William, you could go and race that. You could go and it doesn't seem to be what it once was for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it? But it's weird how it seems to move from one country dominating for a while and then shift.
Yeah.
And they have good years and bad years.
Look at America at the minute as well. You've got so many fast American riders at the minute. And again, a country whenever I started who had no one really.
Yeah.
You had Gwynn, and then after that, that was it. And now, whether it's the effect of Gwynn doing so well, whether it's, I mean, the stuff that Nico Mullally's done on the East Coast and promoting race, and that's only going to build that again, I think.
Yeah, it's a strong scene.
Yeah.
Keep an eye out for that lot. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I'd say Gwynn will be back at the front again next year.
You think? I mean, he's had a super rough year, hasn't he? That's been a horrible, with a big team move and a big announcement to then have a season like that is,
yeah,
that's rough.
It's rough, but I think he just has reserves of speed that mightn't be there this year. That he'll get, he's had niggles. He's, the last 2 years really have been full of niggling injuries for him. And I think, I don't know. I think I'm always fascinated by riders who have, it's like Valentino Rossi in MotoGP. He's the best Sunday racer on that grid. Like, obviously in downhill on Saturday because of the TV, but like the guys that can turn up, like the Troy Brosnans that can turn up at any track in any weather and be in the top three.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating. I think that's a really interesting thing about downhill. And I think Gwynn has that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he has the ability to see time, where time can be made and lost and stuff. And I think, he'll be back next year.
So other than Gwynn, who do you think can challenge that kind of Amery and Loic at the top?
I felt, and it's in no way detracting from Loic's Worlds win. I felt bad that Troy didn't win Worlds this year because he's just so impressive. Like in the first few years that I was sort of covering World Cups, Greg had an unbelievable run. I think it was 3 years where he was never in the top five.
Yeah.
And Troy's now that guy. Like, he's just so consistent.
It's 6 years in the top three, I think.
Was it?
Yeah, but since 2014, he's not been outside the top three. I think that's right. Which is insane.
It's just like, and I think he's just got those two guys in front of him who are, I think, Loic and Amery are really pushing each other into the realms of being better and better and better. But I think Troy will challenge them. Danny beat them at the last race, so Danny obviously. And the GM, Greg, can still do it. And seeing Greg get another couple of World Cups would be good as well.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he's been doing well at the end of this season and been disappointed. To see him angry with those sort of race results is awesome.
Yeah, Greg, I have a lot of respect for Greg because, to reference him again, he is like the Valentino Rossi in that he doesn't need to still be out there doing that. You know, he's made his career, he's made his money, and yet he loves bike racing. And he's got this, like, he'd tell you where a Hungarian downhiller, long retired, finished in 2001 at Leger, do you know what I mean? It's like, he's just got this. He loves racing, and I think.
Yeah.
And I think the technology's come to Greg as well a bit. Like, I mean, nobody heard it apart from the people I said it in front of, but I did say in Lourdes that year, he'll win in Fort William with the 29er. because that's just the perfect medium of bike, rider and track.
Yeah.
And I think the bikes have really helped Greg prolong. When you watch those videos of him on an orange.
Yeah, it looks back in the ridiculous, day,
and it looks
doesn't
like
it?
A BMX. And you're yeah. just like, how was no one looking at that going, this could all be bigger?
Yeah.
Because you talk to Warner about it and he'd say like, or that really good book Steve Jones did, the first quarter. The angles weren't far off on those factory bikes. It was just the size of them was really off. They just went, yeah, it's a size large. And it was never a size. If you're someone Greg or Rob's height, that's not a big enough bike for you.
Yeah, because he's been pushing bike size as much as he can his whole career, from what I can remember, putting headsets in and offset things here and there and just trying to stretch out. But
and unbelievably, he was right.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there was probably a big period there where brands were giving riders bikes as opposed to listening to what they needed from them.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like he pushed that through with Santa Cruz and good on him for getting that all up and running.
And it's massive, that bike. If you stand beside it, it's huge.
Well,
but then he gets on it and it fits him. Yeah. You go, he's tall. Do you know what I mean?
It's and he's made it longer this year, right? With a little back end
little
mod.
Extenders on there, There's been a couple of different versions of them.
Interesting stuff.
Interesting.
Cool. Yeah. So from someone who spends a lot of time involved with bikes and in the scene, what do you think's going well for mountain biking right now? And what do you think it could do better?
The field reporting is through the roof. I think we're doing... I mean, I would say this, but I think in terms of how it's presented on a screen, whether that be a laptop or it's a TV, I think it's night and day from what it was.
Yeah.
I understand the people who say they want the return of Freecaster and stuff, and that sort of, like, I know looser feel to what we do, but I watch a lot of those back to make notes, and it is night and day. And it's just Rob in an echoey box shouting. And like, what you see of mountain biking on a screen now is really, really good. And I think in print, it's also got better. We've lost some monthly mags, but I think it's made the ones that have survived even better.
Yeah.
I think those periodicals, sort of like the likes of the Cranked, and the Hurly Burlies and stuff, they provided that core scene with something to sit down and read. And I think the monthlies are still doing a great job for the people who want to pick up a mag, get something out of it. And I've worked both sides of that, and I think it's a podcast as well. I mean, I think that's a really good thing for the sport. There's just more channels to consume it from a media point of view, and I think that's only ever going to be healthy. I think I've got a bit of a chip on my shoulder. I think bikes are at the point they should have been at 10 or 15 years ago. I think the geometry of bikes now and the build quality of them is the amount of mechanical failures you see at the bottom of an EWS stage now is negligible.
Yeah, it's impressive, isn't it? Considering how much abuse they're taking. Yeah.
Modern enduro bikes are just, they're phenomenal what they can withstand, especially with me on them. Like, but yeah, no, I think it's good. I think there's a lot of negativity online and in comments sections and stuff. And I just think it's actually, sport's really healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the best it's been for as long as I can remember.
When I first started MBUK, it was like, if you wanted a downhill bike, you had to be prepared to part with £4,000. That was it. And it would be an alloy bike.
Yeah.
And it would break very quickly. Now, like $2,500, it's a lot of money and you can't ever tell yourself it's not. But for the actual components and the frame that you get, I think it's very good. I think if you got into mountain biking tomorrow and you went down the bike shop and you bought a £2,000 trail bike, you don't know you're born compared to what.
Yeah.
Like, I did a couple of downhill races when I was younger and basically broke everything and went, I can't afford to do this.
Yeah, just trying to keep the thing together was enough challenge, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it was that thing, it was like, you were buying stuff not because it was lighter or performance enhancing, because it would last beyond the year. And I think that's really turned around. I think it's in a good place.
Yeah. Happy days. All right, we will wrap up and ask you our four questions.
Okay.
So if our listeners had £150 to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go spend it on?
That's tricky. And I know from listening to these, everyone says coaching, don't they? I honestly would say coaching at something like dirt school or something like that, but I'm not going to because that's no fun if everyone said it.
Have you done any coaching? Have you been on any?
I have, yeah. I've done a couple for magazine features and stuff. And it's one of those weird things. It's like whenever I was younger, I played a bit of golf, and like in golf, it's like it's a done thing.
Yeah.
You get coached. Like I played a bit of football, you get coached, and any other sport I've been involved in, you get coached, and a mountain bike, and it's just riding the bike, isn't it? It's, but I did a couple, and the sort of fundamental things that get pointed out to you, you don't realize you're doing, it's beneficial, but I'm not going to say coaching.
Just before we move on though, what was your biggest takeaway from your coaching? What's the one thing you've kind of stuck with you from it?
Just to dip my heels.
Okay.
As far as I can go.
Yeah.
Because I was riding with I thought my heels were really dipped, but they were just sort of probably just like 1 or 2 degrees dipped. And if you actually just stand like that in the middle of your bike, it's amazing what you can roll down comfortably.
Yeah, drive the bike through stuff a bit better.
And deploy my land anchor, hang a leg out there as much as I can, but that's not really coaching. I'd probably say... I'd probably say tires. 150 tires are stupidly expensive.
Yeah,
now,
I know. Yeah.
I think for the difference tires make to a bike, and I remember getting like long term test bikes from MBUK, and I would say that is somewhere that manufacturers cut corners. It's like if you put top price tires on a bike now, it's a big improvement. What's, the Alpha tires.
What's your go to?
I change a lot, but I would say I've just got an Assegai actually on the front of my Megatar, and that's a brilliant tire.
Okay,
that's a baller. Told me he got one and said it was brilliant, so I foolishly went and bought two, and then rode the bike down my drive, and it was like it was velcroed to the drive, and then quickly went back to like a DHR Minion on the back. And, I'd say Assegai and a Minion.
Okay.
On the back.
Excellent.
Actually, a DHF, because that was my front tire, so it wasn't as worn, so I put it on the back.
Good frugal, I like it.
Yeah.
Cool. If you could wind back the clock then and sit down with yourself, age 16, what advice would you give him?
I don't know. Again, probably the boring ones, like, it'll all work out. Trust me, wink, wink. Don't know.
Would you have done much differently?
This is really boring. You probably should say that, on reflection, I should. Do you know what I wouldn't have done? I wouldn't have, the first 2 or 3 years at uni, I sold my bikes to basically finance alcohol abuse. And I always think, especially since I've been doing EWS, I think, just personally myself, I think my riding's really improved and my confidence has improved. But I always sort of think you've lost 2 or 3 years of just riding experience that you could have.
Yeah.
I have two great bikes as well. I had a Schwinn Straight 6, if you remember them.
Nice, yeah.
And I had a 98 Intense M1.
Wow. That's a good collection.
It's a good collection, and I pissed it all up the wall.
Did it buy you a lot of booze?
I can't even remember, man. It was the days when Snapfax was a thing, and drinks were plentiful, but I'd maybe keep one of them, keep the Schwinn, you can pedal that around. That was a great bike, it was ahead of its time.
Yeah,
as long as it went in a straight line, it worked good.
Excellent. All right, if you could have a coaching session with any rider, who would it be and what would you want to learn from him?
Oh, I don't know. That's awkward. Maybe. I'm going to say someone who's really good at jumping, Brendan or someone like that, and say, teach me how to jump convincingly. Because at the minute, it's all or nothing ET moments. I never really rode anywhere that had a lot of jumps, so yeah. I'm just not that good at it.
It's one of those things, if you haven't gone through that phase when you're younger, I guess, of learning and progressing, it's intimidating, right?
Mountain biking's a really strange sport. Mike Rose wrote a brilliant editorial thing for Dirt Years ago, and it stuck with me, about mountain biking's a bit like a cheese sandwich. And if I say to you, what's in your cheese sandwich, you'll have the same, probably roughly the same components, but it'll be in a very different format. Do you know what I mean? And like, you know, you could have mayo in there, it could be great, it could be a slice, you don't know. And I think mountain biking's very similar to that. Like, I ride with people at EWS, like Nico Turner, Nico Big Air. Like, he's just like, does these, went to Coast Gravity Park, does all these huge jumps. But then when it comes to like steep, slow speed, awkward, Dunkeldy stuff, I really like that. And he doesn't like that. And I think it's a sport of many colours. So I'd say jumping would be my. I'd love to be able to just convincingly jump.
It looks fun, doesn't it? It
looks great. Yeah. I'm just sort of approaching, I'm worried that I'm approaching the age that I've lost that sort of elasticity. And
it definitely hurts more when you hit the ground. It
takes longer.
Yeah.
That shoulder in Madeira took a long time to get right. And it's still not brilliant, but
I'm sure
it'll only get better with age.
Yes, that's
definitely. That's what I hear.
Don't even need Brendan. You just naturally get better. It'll be fine. And then the final question is a new one. What is it, or what do you do every day that you think benefits you?
I think I really enjoy, fundamentally, I really, really enjoy what I do. And it was interesting because I listened to Weaves one and he said about being stressed and stuff and like, you know, and I'm a bit of a stressor as well, but I think with the TV stuff, I've learned to tell myself that stress is actually, in that circumstance, it's healthy because it means that you're focused on what's going on. And when I look back on sort of when I was younger and stuff, my biggest misfortunes and misdemeanors came whenever I thought I was completely in control and everything was cruisy and life was easy. So I've learned to sort of handle stress better through this job. And I'd say I love bike racing and I love writing about bike racing and presenting it to other people. And I think if you've got that, then I think you're in a good place. My dad, I grew up in a pub and my dad used to tell me towards the end of it, he said, I don't enjoy what I do. And he's like, he says, you mess up with school and you want to come and run a pub, you can do that. He said, but you'll never leave this village and you'll end up hating it. And so I went and I did something else. I'm eternally grateful to him for that. And since then, just every now and again, like whenever you're worried about money or get like your flights delayed or something, you have to remind yourself that like I do something brilliant and I'm so into it, it's embarrassing. So yeah, I'd say
that's
that.
Awesome. That's super cool, man. It's a nice place to be.
It's pretty, yeah, it's all right. I mean, it's it is what it is, but yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah, when you work hard for it.
Yeah, I think you've got to work hard. If you're not working hard, you should be doing something else, I think.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, it's a nice place to end. If people want to follow you throughout the year, where's the best place?
You can take your best shot at spelling McLaughlin on my Instagram. It's at Rick McLaughlin. It's all lowercase. Because apparently there is someone else out there who's got that with the space. Or on Red Bull TV, on Red Bull Bike, and on EnduroWorldSeries.com.
Cool.
I'm on all of those.
Awesome. Nice one. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We can finish these beers now.
Finish my pint now, yeah.
Yeah, that's the nice main one. Thing. Cheers, man.
Cheers, mum. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Bye.
All right, that's it for the episode with Rick McLaughlin. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Precision Hydration for supporting the podcast. Head to precisionhydration.com to learn more about your specific hydration needs and for your free hydration plan. To get 20% off all Precision Hydration products, just use the code DOWNTIME, all in capitals, at the checkout. You'll find the links that you need in the show notes over on downtimepodcast.com. If you've got a few minutes, then leave us a review wherever it is that you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast and get yourself some exclusive Downtime Podcast goodies, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.